So, jetzt folgt das Interview mit Aspen Hammer. Er ist Lecturer für Philosophie an der University of Essex und hat 2002 das Buch Stanley Cavell, Skepticism, Subjectivity and the Ordinary veröffentlicht, hat über Adorno gearbeitet und einen Vortrag auf der Tagung über Stanley Cavells praktische Philosophie und moralischen Perfektionismus, einen Vortrag gehalten über politischen Romantizismus, und dazu führen wir das Interview und besprechen auch eben die Frage nach dem Gewöhnlichen, und dazu ist ein Buch erschienen, Die Unheimlichkeit des Gewöhnlichen und andere philosophische Essays über Stanley Cavell. Stanley Cavell zählt zu den prominentesten amerikanischen Philosophen der Gegenwart. Seine Bücher schlagen Verbindungen eben nicht nur zwischen verschiedenen philosophischen Traditionen, sondern auch von Philosophie zur Literatur, Literaturkritik, Theater und Film. Und dies kann eben wie ein verwirrendes Beziehungsnetz zwischen Autoren und Genres und Werken erscheinen, von dem, wie er über Skeptizismus zur Philosophy of Ordinary Language kommt, Shakespeare und die Romantik dann mit Hollywoods Melodramen und Komödien verbindet. Und das sind eben Grundthemen, die Cavell im Ausgang von G.L. Austin und insbesondere eben von Wittgensteins philosophischen Untersuchungen gewinnt. Diese Kohärenz in der Vielgestaltigkeit ist dann eben ein Querschnitt, der in dem Aufsatzband Die Unheimlichkeit des Gewöhnlichen zu finden ist. Und zwar ist das 2002 im Fischer Verlag erschienen.
Maybe we start like this. You had this talk on the political romanticism on Stanley Cavell, but maybe we can start in this way. Wie ist es dazu gekommen, also nicht in dieser Art, dass du über Stanley Cavell arbeitest und dieses Verhältnis des Skeptizismus, der Subjektivität und dem Gewöhnlichen? Wie ist dieses Verhältnis eigentlich zum politischen Romantizismus und wie ist es zu deiner Arbeit an diesen Themen gekommen? Was sind deine Interessen an diesen Themen?
Well, I think it springs from my interest in the relationship between politics and aesthetics.
Yeah.
Because in Cavell's work, you see a very original conjunction taking place between the political and the aesthetic, or between the political and the literary, I should say. And that's connected to the moment of the autobiographical Cavell, the interest in the personal human voice that Cavell finds has been forgotten in philosophy. There's the claim in Derrida, famously, that philosophy has somehow suppressed writing, whereas in Cavell the claim is that philosophy has suppressed the voice, the human voice, in its singularity, in its capacity to express the autobiographical position of the individual. His or her unique history must somehow come in and make itself felt even in philosophy. Because in philosophy we have traditionally, well, throughout the whole history of philosophy, there's been a tendency towards wanting to say that you have to find something which is a priori,
yeah,
like logic or transcendental logic that can somehow ground the rationality of the claims you make, whether these claims are about the world or about others or about morality, whatever. In Cavell, there is no such a priori backing. In that sense, Cavell is a truly post-metaphysical and post, let's say, post-analytical thinker, in the sense that he sees philosophy as almost Socratic, as being able to take part in a dialogue, and this dialogue should be such that it is capable of challenging the individual and, as it were, bringing out aspects or sides of the individual that he or she didn't know existed. But to return to, the way, I think in part the reason why I'm interested in this conjunction between aesthetics and politics and how the most intimate moments of literary self-revelation is supposed to have a kind of political impact that I've been working on Adorno for quite a while. I've been writing a book on Adorno's aesthetics and how that aesthetics embodies a political dimension.
Yeah.
And I see deep parallels between Cavell and Adorno in this respect, that this political voice becomes interesting when it's a voice that comes from outside, as it were, which doesn't have a clear connection to any party or any universally recognized cause, but which can come from outside in a kind of experimental way to challenge the way we think, something disruptive, something that can introduce something that's radically new in the way we configure reality. And I think in a way that's how Adorno thinks of the artwork. The artwork is for him a way to radically revolutionize the way we look at the world and the way we look at things.
Yeah.
And in a way that's precisely, or in a way, I think it's quite similar what goes on in Cavell and Cavell's understanding of the singular individual who speaks out sort of against a total social situation, such as, for instance, in his reading of Ibsen's Dollhouse, where Nora, you know, completely, she makes herself unintelligible in order to raise a claim that's highly radical, that puts her whole previous life into question. When she leaves her husband at the end of the play, she's completely incomprehensible to Torvald and these other people with whom she's been living, but she's nevertheless opening a whole new territory, a whole new space of freedom, which I find interesting, and which I see as a kind of allegory of what's good. An interesting art can be art. Kunst has perhaps capacity to open up that kind of space for us in lucky moments.
Das wäre aber ein Ort des Unbestimmten. Also Nora, die diesen Mann verlässt, ihren Ehemann, weiß nicht, was sie erwartet, also wenn sie in diese Welt hinausgeht. Und da wäre tatsächlich die Frage, wenn Kunst etwas Unbestimmtes ist, was bedeutet es dann tatsächlich für die politische Theorie? Also die ja tatsächlich mit Gerechtigkeitsüberlegungen was ganz anderes will. Das war ja heute das Problem mit eigentlich Rawls und Cavell.
That's been a problem in the discussions we've been having in the seminar. Yeah. How do you actually go from this to the political in the narrower or more traditional sense? I don't think that Cavell ultimately gives you an answer to that. And in a way, I don't think there is an easy, straightforward answer to it. However, I think in any living democracy, you need these oppositional voices. You need these. You need spaces in which divergent oppositional voices can make themselves felt. And again, I see much of contemporary art as embodying that claim to a radical configuration of experience.
Yeah.
But there's no easy transition to the political in the narrower sense, certainly. That's a challenge that everyone's faced with.
Yeah.
And there's no universal philosophical solution that's going to unburden us of the task, you know, making that translation a transition.
Da würde ich gerne aber noch mal zu dem Vortrag nachfragen, was genau mit dem Sublimen eigentlich gemeint ist. Also Sublime in welchem Sinne? Also der Sublimierung?
Well, I mean, das Sublime, das Erhabene.
Das Erhabene.
Das Erhabene. well, I mean, traditionally... Traditionally, that's been associated with something that's grand and big and overpowering, something in the face of which we feel small or crushed. We feel how little we are, like the starry night sky is a classical example of the sublime. That's absolutely not what I have in mind when I talk about das Erhabene in connection with Cavell's work. Cavell himself uses the term das Erhabene, and when he uses it, and I think it's an interesting way to think of the das Erhabene. Das Erhabene is that which we cannot fully comprehend or fully grasp. It doesn't necessarily have to be big, but it's something which is which speaks to us in a language that is not discursive in any straightforward sense. I think much advanced artistic work speaks to us in this way, in a way which is ungraspable in one sense, which resists easy, quick interpretations, works that we need to that need to make themselves felt in us for quite a while before we can fully understand their impact, and so on and so forth. And the question that both Adorno and Cavell raise, and which I find interesting, is whether that can have any political impact or bearing. And again, certainly not in the immediate sense of being something that can enter into the actual conversation of justice in the Rawlsian sense. But I think that these are spaces in which we can try to position ourselves as more authentic human beings vis-a-vis the political. And that's the romantic dimension of Cavell's work, which I find quite intriguing and interesting and stimulating.
Yeah. Yeah, this authentic... Dieser Versuch der Romantik, eigentlich ein authentisches Selbst zu etablieren, wäre nicht übereinstimmend mit dem, was mit Stimme gemeint sein könnte, überhaupt eine philosophische Stimme.
Exactly, exactly, yes. It coincides with Cavell's interest in the autobiographical. And the autobiographical is something that's not really given. We're not given with an autobiography. We have to find it somewhere. We have to explore ourselves. And philosophy is one arena in which we may be able to challenge ourselves, put ourselves into question, in the hope of maybe reaching a higher awareness of ourselves, a more qualified stand or take on our situation. And again, I would say, you know, art is another such arena. Writing is one such arena in which we seek a higher and more, if you wish, authentic form of existence. I think that's interesting, Cavell, how that's always something to be striven after. It's never something given. It's not as if you can just know immediately who you are, but it's something that takes work on yourself, a kind of self-formation, which is the task in many ways of philosophy.
So the question, the next question. I think we have enough time because the others will come. So
yeah, we can just go on.
Yeah. Between skepticism and the ordinary, because if skepticism is the critic on the skeptical position, is that the skeptical won't accept how the world is, or that won't know that the world is. The ordinary language philosophy would has the possibility to show where that the world is like it is in the way we talk. This is so where do you see or where do you see things? Also that, also wo siehst du, dass Cavell sozusagen eine interessante neue Position hat, denn Shakespeare, also indem wir Shakespeare-Stücke bearbeitet, ist es dann möglich, da aufzuzeigen, was die skeptische Position an Weltzerstörung eigentlich leistet. Also dadurch, dass der andere als dass dem anderen als Person, die vielleicht geliebt wird, auch nicht mehr das Vertrauen entgegengebracht wird und so weiter. Also das ist ja eine Form, da werden Welten zerstört durch eine skeptische Position. Das heißt, das Skeptische ist immer ein nachträgliches Zerstören, möglicherweise das Nicht-Akzeptieren der Position des anderen.
Ja. Yeah.
Wie steht das in Beziehung? Oder wie kann man da eine Beziehung herstellen zu dem, was dann ein romantisches, harmonisches, gemeinschaftliches Leben sein kann, wenn Shakespeare oder auch Cavell also in seiner Reflexion auf Shakespeare zeigen kann, wie genau diese Form des Harmonischen Shakespeare in seiner Position in der Reformation eigentlich zu schreiben, mit dem Wissen, die Puritaner werden kommen und alles ist tatsächlich eine andere Welt. Also,
I think that perhaps my understanding of romanticism isn't as harmonistic or it's much more about coming to terms with, and it's essential to Cavell's construction of the skeptic, to try to come to terms with human finitude. And human finitude for Stanley Cavell means basically separateness, the fact that we are separate, and that any attempt to objectify or control or dominate or reify the other is going to destroy our relationship with this other person. That's basically the morale of this analysis of King Lear. King Lear doesn't accept the independence of his daughters. He doesn't accept Cordelia's love because this love calls himself into question. It calls his dependency on her and that love, which is a fact for him, but which he doesn't want to acknowledge, into question.
Yeah.
So both romanticism and the reading of Shakespeare, I think, is about the same issue, namely, how do we come to terms with this finitude? How do we come to terms with the fact of human separateness? And how can we have relationships between human beings and between humans and the world that would not be based on domination and fear of separation, but on an acceptance, an acknowledgement of otherness and difference and separation. That's what maturing to come to maturity means to be able to accept separateness, which involves mourning, kawa. Now I'm here on Freudian ground. I mean, for Freud, as we all know, to accept loss entails mourning. You have to be able to mourn loss in order to achieve autonomy. And I think that's also a crucial element in, certainly in my understanding of the Romantics, that they are engaged in a form of mourning. It comes out extremely well in Cavell's reading of an American Romantic, Thoreau, and his early work on Thoreau. Thoreau is engaged in a form of mourning, a kind of learning to accept the fragility of human life and the otherness of others, as it were. Here again, I see parallels between Cavell and Adorno. For Adorno, likewise, there's almost an ethical imperative for us to try to release the object from our holds, whether these are conceptual holds or maybe technologically enforced holds on the world. It really amounts to the same thing to be able to overcome that attitude and accept the thing, accept the other, and accept the claim that the other has upon me without being afraid, as it were.
So today, this conference is on Erkennen und Anerkennen, on the practical philosophy of Cavell. And so, one question from Willich. What difference do you see between the term acknowledgement, knowing, and knowledge? And this in relation to recognition, within the term recognition, the radical recognition term of Honneth's philosophy, and the cognitive recognition in the term of Erkennen. Let's finish. So the first, I would say, what is different, what's the difference between the term acknowledgement, knowing, and knowledge? Because I think this is something between the skeptical and maybe ordinary and romantic
decision. Yes, yes. I mean, for Cavell, this term acknowledgement arises. It's important, arises for him in his analysis of all the minds, in which the question for the traditional epistemologist is, how can I know with certainty that others are bearers of minds and that they have minds? In other words, how can I, given what's available to me, namely a body that seems to express things, how can I infer from that to the fact that, or to the assumption that there is something like a mind or a soul or a conscious human being, which in that respect is similar to myself? It's a weird type of skepticism, but in fact, I think Cavell is right that this kind of skepticism arises in real life as well, and that you can see examples of it in Shakespeare. You can see implications of that kind of skepticism in Shakespeare. In any event, if you remain, as it were, in the attitude of a pure knower, as the Cartesian, traditional Cartesian skeptic would be vis-a-vis the other, you would never be able to see the other as a living human being, because the only thing you can know in the strict sense is the body. And in order to understand the body as a sentient being, a being that has a life, is to be able to acknowledge this other as someone who has an inner life. And this acknowledgement is something that for Cavell is based on a kind of claim that the other raises. it can be situations, for example, his example is someone in pain. If you relate to that person with in a state of complete indifference, you will not be able to, in a sense, know that this person is in pain. If your reaction is one of sheer indifference, you don't really know that this other person is in pain. You only know that this other person is in pain if you respond, if you are responsive to this other person's suffering in some way. So you only know this in the sense that insofar as you are capable of revealing yourself to the other somehow, to respond actively to the other, perhaps by helping him, perhaps by turning your back to him, but you don't really know the other person unless you have this capacity for acknowledgement. So that's why my answer to the question is that acknowledgement is a dimension of knowing. It's not separate from knowing, but it's a dimension of knowing, which is not grounded on epistemic criteria that makes this acknowledgement certain in a way that's going to make the Cartesian skeptic happy. In fact, the Cartesian skeptic will never be happy with this analysis. That's why Cavell says that we have to accept skepticism. Indeed, we have to live our skepticism. To live our skepticism means to accept that I can never assure myself fully of the other person's claim on me simply by seeking to know him or her in the sense of akentness. I will also have to do something which exceeds this conceptual grasp of the other, which is an act of empathy.
So the question is in relation to Honneth's term of acknowledgement, of recognition. Where is it different than from this Cavell's recognition of Honneth's?
I mean, for Honneth, he is interested in anerkennung, acknowledgement, if you wish, as a social theoretical concept, and is especially interested in social struggles and how these social struggles have an inbuilt logic. Inbuilt logic is roughly that social groups seek recognition in their struggles, and social struggle is a form of desire for recognition. And for him, this desire for recognition must be analyzed in complete distinction from, or in opposition to, problems of knowledge. For him, the whole dimension of knowing and acknowledging doesn't quite arise. He sees acknowledging or anerkenning as a completely separate issue from knowing. And that obviously sets him apart from Stanley Cavell's work, certainly, for whom acknowledgement is a dimension of knowing, an ineradical dimension of knowing.
Dann nochmal ganz kurz auf die Uneinigkeit des Gewöhnlichen einzugehen. Vielleicht, wie ist diese Zusammenstellung dieser Essays zustande gekommen? Also David Sparty war auch an der Zusammenstellung beteiligt. Also da sind ja tatsächlich ganz unterschiedliche Texte aus zum Beispiel Anerkennung und Wiederentdeckung des Gewöhnlichen, also sehr frühe Aufsätze von Cavell, Shakespeare, Film und das Gewöhnliche. Da finde ich den Text Eine Lektüre des Wintermärchens eigentlich relativ problematisch, weil wenn man das Wintermärchen liest, würde ich sagen, die skeptische, man kann nicht wirklich von der skeptischen Position sprechen, weil es ist ja eigentlich bis das Misstrauen, also bei Shakespeare wird das Misstrauen ja immer durch eine andere Person, die sich davon die bestimmte Interessen hat, Machtinteressen zum Beispiel, verfolgt Erbe werden zu wollen und so weiter, ist eigentlich, wird diese Zerstörung eigentlich des anderen eingeleitet durch die Intervention eigentlich eines anderen, der das Glück der anderen zerstören will. Das ist auch bei Othello ja eigentlich der Fall. Und dadurch.
Also, bevor wir jetzt das Glück der nächsten Sendung zerstören, diese Gespräche setzen sich noch fort. Nächsten Sonntag sprechen wir mit Fritz Schütze, also das ist ein Interview, das auf der Biografietagung über biografische Prozesse und kollektive Identität stattgefunden hat. Und bis Ende Mai wird jeden Sonntag 18 bis 20 Uhr Exit and Voice im TAT stattfinden und dienstags von 13 bis 15 Uhr hier auf Radio X. Am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft.
It came out on the Akademie Verlag some years ago.
Birgit Becker Knobloch, schönen Tag noch.
Wunderschönen guten Tag hier zu Recycled Music. In der ersten Hälfte meiner Sendung möchte ich heute auf das leider nicht mehr existente Vertriebsmonster Eva zu sprechen kommen. Wir hatten ja uns viele schöne kleinere Labels immer nahegebracht und da hören wir jetzt einfach mal ein paar von, wo ich nicht weiß, wie die jetzt weiter vertrieben werden. Sei es drum, als erstes Jimsters mit Message from the Hub.